Blog Talk Radio.
Very African. Come and step in Brother Temple, see what's happening. You'll take the bass flow, coming from a zero. Tell me what a sissy know. Funk a lesson is a new flow. Stalking, walking in my big black boots. Living off the earth, eating herbs and fruits. The children await me by the mountain and the river. And gather round the fire for the scroll that I deliver. The speak of a house is from the sand to the sky. And devils ever doubt and want to measure how high. Your life reveals you, your mind can't catch it. Dimensions of a god go far beyond brackets. Coming to my oven, devils coming, you burn. I can always feel vulture with the strength and black word. You're pissing me off because you swear you're higher level. Back to your cave, get yourself together. Chili and Magilla, chocolate and vanilla. How can polar bears swing on vines with the gorillas, please? Check your reason because it's something amiss. My home is a void, you're drowning in an abyss. I teach you funk code and don't preach a rap rhyme. Harambe to the sun as the mortals ask time.
Man, what time is it?
The funk lesson comes, the sundial speaks.
Man, what time is it?
The building of the strong are the lessons of the meek.
Verbalizer, what time is it?
My science is deep, my blackness is deep.
How deep?
Deep, deeper than Atlantis. Deeper than the seafloor, traveled by the mantis. Your copycats will never know. With you, the funk will never flow. But that's another blow. Make your move, thief apprentice, I never step. I'm a tribal move, your master hasn't figured yet. Bring your weapons to my sword and shield. What's the higher level if your shit ain't real? My mystic magic, what you gonna do? Think before you step, before the rebels, silly mortal you. I tried to warn you, but your mind won't catch. You're just cookies in my oven. If I wanna burn a batch, you just burn.
Vainglorious, this is protected by the red, the black, and the green with the key, sissy.
Like this, like that, and like that, like this. How dark is the world, how strong is a fist. Originals come from the sand and the sword to the concrete, fighting wars in the street. The day of outrage, history, another page. You like the word of this, but now there is a brother Jay, the prince of warriors. Leading masses, stomping liver lift, punks playing asses. The damn sissies always talk full of glory. Sissy bomb is coming, but that's another story. So many people forgot where they came. Disrespect religion, but the living is lame. Black, white, how you living? Blowing the now. So many mortals, the chimes of a sundial. To the east, teaching gods to be what it was, what it is, and again shall be. What if my mind state if my state ain't black? But Moses, Malcolm, and Huey are back. And the voice to a many going verb to verb. Sit back and take heed, brother, you must learn. Swimming in the books, and the books ain't given. The scales of a black man weighs in the living.
What time is it?
I dwell among the mortals, the time is in the verse.
What time is it?
Positive nature, mortal soul, it curse.
What time is it?
Shadows in the sunlight, balance in the birth. Tick tock, tick, we go sun to moon. Verbalizer speaks, it's a quarter to doom. Self-destruction is not a key function. Another round the leaders, cause the people keep fronting. When will they realize the body needs head? It's more than what's said when a leader lies dead. Coming to the darkness, past is light. Death meaning life as the pharaohs take flight. Too much degrees for a silly pale thief. You can't define what's direct from the east. God protect me, he selects me. God makes a path so the world respects me. 0 to 9, grandest creator. I pray for those on both sides of equator. Professor X, when will they learn? One spike enters doors, death, no return, no return.
This is an invitation to the crossroads, if you dare, sissy. With a key.
Welcome to another edition of Your World News. That was none other than X-Clan, and I am none other than Solo, broadcasting from the belly of the beast and the belly of the beast, straight out of Washington, D.C., in the epicenter of the rapacious capitalist nation, otherwise known as the U.S., and joined on the line with me. I'm about to patch him through in one moment. is none other than Peter Fowler. And I was just, and as you know, this is a tribute to the great, the late great Malcolm X, El Haj Malik El Shabazz. And we're going to be playing some classic clips, some sound bites from Brother Malcolm X. And we're going to be talking about news as well. We're going to try to put everything into context in terms of what we hear from Malcolm, things that he said, you know, 40 plus years ago. Obviously, this is the day that he was assassinated, February 21st, 1965. And so, you know, well over 40 years ago, and it's chilling to, you know, any time folks like myself and Peter even evoke the words of Malcolm X, because, you know, when you would just even think of the name Malcolm X, you know, if you've really studied the man and read his autobiography and studied his life and how he evolved and where he came from and things that inspired him and how he inspired so many others, powerful leaders of the time, and how he inspires and empowers you. You can't not, yeah, I'll use a double negative. You can't not, get goosebumps. I mean, they run all throughout your body. And so I'm excited to do this show, because as long as we continue to discuss the life and work of Brother Malcolm X, his legacy will live on forever. His legacy will live on forever. And so I'm going to play a quick clip of him to kind of set the show going. And then on the other end, I'm going to bring on Peter Fowler, who's joining us from the Mississippi of the Southwest, otherwise known as Arizona, with that buckethead governor, Jan Brewer, and all the other regressive elements that run through that filthy, racist administration that's overseeing that stolen state. And we'll get things going. We'll get things going.
This afternoon, we want to talk about the ballot or the bullet. The ballot or the bullet explains itself. But before we get into it, since this is the year of the ballot or the bullet, I would like to clarify some things that refer to me personally concerning my own personal position. I'm still a Muslim. That is, my religion is still Islam. My religion is still Islam. I still credit Mr. Muhammad for what I know and what I am. He's the one who opened my eyes. So today, though Islam is my religious philosophy, my political, economic, and social philosophy is black nationalism. You and I... As I say, if we bring up religion, we'll have differences, we'll have arguments, we'll never be able to get together. But if we keep our religion at home, keep our religion in the closet, keep our religion between ourselves and our God, but when we come out here, we have a fight that's common to all of us against the enemy who is common to all of us. Whether you are a Christian or a Muslim or a nationalist, we all have the same problem. They don't hang you because you're a Baptist, they hang you because you're black. They don't attack me because I'm a Muslim, they attack me because I'm black. They attack all of us for the same reason. All of us catch hell from the same enemy. We're all in the same bag, in the same boat. We suffer political oppression, economic exploitation, and social degradation. All of them from the same enemy. The government has failed us. You can't deny that. Anytime you live in the 20th century and you walking around here singing, "We shall overcome," the government has failed us. This is part of what's wrong with you. You do too much singing. Today it's time to stop singing and start swinging. And I'm here to tell you, in case you don't know it, that you got a new generation of black people in this country who don't care anything whatsoever about odds. They don't want to hear you, old Uncle Tom, handkerchief heads talking about the odds. No. This is a new generation. If they're going to draft these young black men and send them over to Korea or South Vietnam to face 800 million Chinese. If you're not afraid of those odds, you shouldn't be afraid of these odds. And when I speak, I don't speak as a Democrat or a Republican, nor an American. I speak as a victim of America's so-called democracy. You and I have never seen democracy. All we've seen is hypocrisy. We don't see any American dream. We've experienced only the American nightmare. And the generation that's coming up now can see it and are not afraid to say it. If you go to jail, so what? If you're black, you were born in jail. If you're black, you were born in jail. In the North as well as the South. Stop talking about the South. Long as you're south of the Canadian border, you're South. This is why I say it's the ballot or the bullet. It's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody. America today finds herself in a unique situation. Historically, revolutions are bloody. Oh, yes, they are. They have never had a bloodless revolution or a nonviolent revolution. That don't happen even in Hollywood. You don't have a revolution in which you love your enemy. And you don't have a revolution in which you're begging the system of exploitation to integrate you into it. Revolutions overturn systems. Revolutions destroy systems. A revolution is bloody. But America is in a unique position. She's the only country in history in a position actually to become involved in a bloodless revolution. All she's got to do is give the black man in this country everything that's doing. Everything. I hope that the white man can see this. Because if you don't see it, you're finished. If you don't see it, you're going to become involved in some action in which you don't have a chance. We don't care anything about your atomic bomb. It's useless. Because other countries have atomic bombs. When two or three different countries have atomic bombs, nobody can use it. So it means that the white man today is without a weapon. If you want some action, you got to come on down to earth. And there's more black people on earth than there are white people on earth. It'll be the ballot, or it'll be the bullet. It'll be liberty, or it'll be death. And if you're not ready to pay that price, don't use the word freedom in your vocabulary.
That was none other than Malcolm. I just don't know how anyone can listen to that. I mean, I guess you're aggressive, if you're aggressive, some, as you would categorize, a handkerchief head Negro or some, you know, regressive Peckerwood that is a white supremacist, then I guess I could see where that man's words and his work would scare the living crap out of you. Even to this day, I could see, you know, even 45, 46 years after his assassination, I could see where just the image of that man makes some folks uncomfortable and petrifies them. But Malcolm, what a man. And yeah, he may have had his life stolen from him at age 39, but thank God he lived, because his work and his words and his everything, his work, you know, lives on in folks like myself every single day, and it will never die. Just like so many other, you know, freedom fighters and that we've seen. And so, you know, this is the 21st day of February. This is part of Black History Month, but we're not doing a show around Malcolm because it's Black History Month, or even necessarily because this is the day that he had his life stolen from him. Yes, we're paying homage to him, and we're mentioning the fact that this was his assassination day, because you best believe the NYPD and the FBI and the CIA and the U.S. government, it may have been a black man that pulled the trigger, but they were fully behind it, fully behind it. You know, we know by the work of Baba Zak Kondo in his book, Assassination of Malcolm X, and the work of so many other folks, we know that the U.S. government played a role in Malcolm's assassination. That is irrefutable, and the truth will surface fully one day, not just to folks like myself and Peter, but also to the masses. And at that time, people will really see, even when Dr. King's his assassination and the U.S. government's role that it played in the assassination of Dr. King, when these things surface years from now, people will start to wake their eyes up and get their heads out of the sand and see what this government has been all about. And that's, you know, and that's the time where I hope that we see a change, because until people wake up, you know, we're not going to see this society change into being more egalitarian, more humane, you know. So anyways, welcome Peter Fowler onto the line. And Peter, everyone knows who you are. You know, activist from Columbus, Ohio, Cleveland, Ohio, but is sweltering and not necessarily physically, but figuratively sweltering in the bowels of Arizona right now. Folks know who you are. Peter, if you can open up with kind of giving us, you know, what Malcolm meant to you, what impact Malcolm's life has upon your life that you're living right now.
Well, you know, I appreciate that, and you mentioned Cleveland, because if I remember correctly, he delivered the ballot for the bullet address in Cleveland, Ohio, my hometown. And so I take a little pride in that too. But, you know, it's that image of Malcolm, you know, the audacity and the indignation that oozed out of him, that I find so exhilarating. You know, just the righteous indignation that swelled up in him, and that he breathed, you know, the words of fire, you know, that he breathed out, the words of truth and the words of justice that he breathed out in the tradition of, you know, the ancient prophets. And that's where I want to jump off at that point right there, in terms of Malcolm. And I've said this on the show before, you know, that Malcolm stands in the line of the prophets, the biblical prophets. So I'm not going to belabor that point again. But what I will say is I'll emphasize the way he starts off that particular speech. You know, and this time of year, I always, you know, reread some of Malcolm's original work and also some, you know, biographical work. And I happened to read that particular speech again just last night. And he says that, at the outset of that speech, and we heard it. We heard it on the clip. He said to the crowd, "I'm still a Muslim. My religion is still Islam. That's my personal belief." And, you know, if we stop and think for a minute why he said that, it says a lot about the moment, and it says a lot about Malcolm. And he makes that proclamation because it's the post-Mecca Malcolm, right? It's after he'd been censured by the Nation of Islam and Elijah Muhammad, and then he broke off from the Nation of Islam, and he started his own movement. And unfortunately, you know, his life was cut short before that was allowed to blossom. But it's his Muslim disposition, Solomon, that allows him to have the philosophy that he has, okay? And I say that because it is such a unique voice in the public discourse in America, in American history, past and present even. And that's what has been so fascinating, first off, for me, to look at Malcolm, and also so invigorating. And it's led me, Solomon, it really has. Malcolm has been an inspiration for me to really try to get inside his mind and see what was it that made him tick and allowed him to have the disposition that he did in terms of being able to critique America like no other religious figure had been able to do in the 20th century, for certain in the 20th century, had not been able to critique America and Americanism the way Malcolm was able to do. And it was the fact that he was non-Christian, all right, the fact that he was a Muslim, first in the Nation of Islam, just kind of a pseudo-Islam group that's peculiar to the United States. Black Muslims, they were called early on, Nation of Islam, and then his own movement, which was he tried to make it a more pure version of Islam when he returned from his from the Hajj and his journey through Africa. But it's that non-Christian and Islamic worldview and philosophy that allowed him to have what I call an oppositional philosophy, Solomon, an oppositional philosophy, because that's what we hear in all of his speeches, in every sentence that comes out of Malcolm's mouth. He is in opposition to the injustice and the inhumanity that is part and parcel of America and Americanism, particularly toward her people of color. And so that's what sets Malcolm apart, at least philosophy-wise, is the fact that he had an oppositional philosophy grounded in his non-Christian religion. And he makes that very plain. He's very proud of the fact that he's a religious man. You know, and that's something that sometimes gets lost. And a lot of the biographers lament that, you know, even as he's remembered, he's not remembered as a religious man first and foremost, but that's the way he saw himself first and foremost, was as a minister, right? Minister Malcolm. Even after the break with Elijah Muhammad, maybe even more so after the break with Elijah Muhammad. But nevertheless, it was an oppositional philosophy. And why is that important? All right, this is the point I want to get at, and that we need to take away from this conversation on today's Bullet Day. And I call it Bullet Day because it's a day that someone was taken by a bullet. And ironically, I'm sure we'll come back to this, but ironically, today's Bullet Day, February 21st, third Monday, falls on President's Day too, right? So there's kind of a tragic irony in that. But my point is that the other critiques that we have heard, and you know, certainly not often enough, from religious voices, have been of the predominant or mainline religious tradition in the United States, Christianity. But Christianity is so enmeshed in Americanism that they're almost one and the same at this point in time, for certain. I mean, we hear some radical Christian voices in the 19th century, and in fact, one of the inspirations for some of Malcolm's rhetoric was a Christian minister by the name of Henry Highland Garnett. Right? That's where, you know, Malcolm gets that "by any means necessary" rhetoric. You know, that was from a Christian minister, Henry Highland Garnett. And so we see the evolution of Christianity as it morphs into this pro-American philosophy. And so by the time we get to the 1960s, that's what we're used to. That's what we have. And it's even more so today. It's really ridiculous. But that's a whole other conversation. But Malcolm stands out in his oppositional philosophy because he's non-Christian, and that gives him the framework, the worldview, to oppose Americanism and to really deconstruct America and see the injustice for what it is and not be overwhelmed with this false patriotism and this nationalistic rah-rah bullshit, that we're indoctrinated into, that we're brainwashed into as starting in grade school, but that was one of the things that allowed Malcolm to have such a different perspective and such a clarion call for us to see America very differently. And like he says, and no one could say it better than Malcolm, that he doesn't see an American dream, he sees an American nightmare. That's what's been so inspirational to me, and I hope provides some inspiration to those who are listening, particularly folks who maybe grew up in the church or still in the church, or even non-religious. But just consider the fact that it was Malcolm's, that he was non-Christian, that he was able to have the framework that he has to be able to critique Americanism, and Christianity doesn't allow that because Christianity is so enmeshed. And so when we hear the Christian voices, particularly in the 20th century, like I said, in the antebellum 19th century, we hear more radical Christian voices. But by the time we get to the 1960s, Christianity is so enmeshed with the system and the apparatus that they're not able to critique it. Malcolm stands apart from that, and I love him for that. And that's why we need to continue to hear Malcolm, because he's relevant. He's just as relevant now as he was in 1965. And you and I were at the same conference when one of our colleagues suggested that we de-emphasize, some of the leaders of the 60s and some of those great revolutionaries. And I couldn't disagree more with that. That the voices like Malcolm, we need to hear them, and our young people need to hear them, maybe even more now than ever, right? We definitely do well to pay homage to Malcolm today.
Definitely, you bring up a good point. We need to hear him, much more. I think much more even today than back then, and I certainly was not alive at the same time Malcolm was alive, but he's alive within me every day. I get up and every day I leave my home and set forth to do the work in the community that folks like Malcolm and Martin and Ida B. Wells and Fannie Lou Hamer, and I can just keep going on and on, have instilled within me, have inspired in me to be doing that strong, productive, progressive, dare I say radical work in the community, whether it's empowering, young people that are incarcerated, or if it's working with the youth to see beyond this white supremacist value system that continues to become imposed upon them, like bullets on a target. So, but his work, Peter, as you said, his words are so important today because so many folks within these stolen borders, otherwise known as America, have, especially folks of color, have had their consciousness just basically continue to be almost decapitated by everything from media to school systems that are just throwing at them left and right these white supremacist values and even like you mentioned, clowns at a conference, at a black cultural conference having the audacity to come up there and say that we need to move away from the rhetoric and words of folks that came before us in the 60s. I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean, the fact that there's actually these ridiculous conversations about that we're living in some kind of post-racist America, some post-racist society, and that there's actually people of color that have actually bought into that and believe that because there's a phenotypically brown-skinned man in the White House, that for some reason, you know, we're living in a post-racist society, the same society that makes it possible for black folks to still only make 60 cents for every dollar that white people make. The same society that for every dollar of wealth that a white person has, black folks have a dime of
right.
wealth for every, you know what I'm saying? So it's the same society that continues to incarcerate, to incarcerate 2.6 million people, and out of which almost half of them are black, and we haven't even gotten to including, you know, brown skinned Latinos, you know. So this is a prison industrial system that is nothing short of the convict lease system. It's an extension of the convict lease system that we saw, and that was an extension of slavery. I mean, so this is, as many scholars and activists have rightfully said, this is the modern day slavery. You know, we look at, you know, white folks being 70, you know, anywhere from 66% to 70% of all cocaine users, yet blacks represent, about 80-82% of all new convictions surrounding that drug. You know, so it's you know, we can go on and on. But, you know, we're not supposed to look at structural or institutional racism. We're supposed to think of racism as somebody calling you nigger or spick or something like that, or gook. That's what we're supposed to think of. We're not supposed to think of it as something structural, something that prevents one from getting FHA home loans, something that moves, that ethnically cleanses, you know, everywhere from Philadelphia to Harlem to Washington, D.C., and on and on and on, you know, through redlining and gentrification. We're not supposed to see these things as being racist. But they're just looming right there. They're looming right there. And Peter, it was the folks like Malcolm that had the audacity, and thank God they had the audacity, thank the Most High that they had the audacity to get up there knowing that any day could have been their last. They got up there and said it like it was. Made it plain. They made it plain. You know, and we have and some of us have our friggin' heads in the sand to believe that this dude Barack Obama, because he's brown, that he gives a damn about the plight of everyday black Americans. He does not. He does not. He has gone out of his way to tap dance around the issue of racism in America. He won't even speak on black issues. When asked pointedly by reporters, he won't even speak on black issues. You know,
right.
And talks in these generalities, and even has the audacity to quote and to genuflect, you know, racist scumbag devils like Ronald Reagan, you know, talking about, you know, raising the tide will raise all boats. Man, well, if somebody is in a yacht and I'm in a dinghy, I don't give a damn how high you raise the tide. It ain't doing nothing for the fact that I'm in a dinghy and I got a little tiny leaf or a paddle and you're cruising along in this, you know, motorized yacht. You know, it doesn't matter what kind of winds you get, you're still moving. This MF-er has the audacity to come out and say that, and on the campaign trail to tell black folks, you know, Barack Obama has the audacity to tell black folks that they need not protest, that they need not protest, they need to respect the decision that was handed down by the judge, the morally, you know, the morally, you know, the vacant judge who acquitted the cops that murdered that shot Sean Bell over 40 times and murdered him. Are you kidding me? We need Malcolm more than ever. So within this show, we're going to talk about Barack Obama. We're going to talk about the recent budget. We're going to talk about all those things. But let me give you. We're gonna do that on the other end. Right now, we're just gonna have another quick clip of This is a 2-minute soundbite of Malcolm. On the other end, on the other side, we're gonna look at the budget. We're gonna look at Barack Obama's budget, and let's see what kind of society we're living in. You know, thank goodness that we had the likes of Malcolm and Martin, who called America for its military industrial complex and its lack of humanity. And so we'll get into that. But here's Malcolm talking about, you know, the joke of American courts.
For 8 weeks in Los Angeles, 14 so-called Negroes sat on trial, charged by the police with assault, charged by the police with intent to commit murder. You haven't read anything about it in the paper. You haven't seen anything about it and heard anything about it from these blue-eyed white so-called liberals. They quieted it down. They hushed it up. And none of the Negro leaders opened up their mouths during the trial. They were silent while they had a rally of 35,000 Negroes in one of those states, Wrigley Field, in Los Angeles, while the all-white jury was in session. And not one of them came forth and mentioned what had happened to those 14 Negroes in that city. And they wonder why things are developing to what they are today. No, you don't get justice in court. A black man can't get justice in court. A black man can't get justice in the court system of America. And I'm telling you, the only way you get justice is in the street. The only way you get justice is in the sidewalk. The only way you get justice is when you make justice for yourself. You never will get justice in the white man's court. No, not me. I never want him to take me to court. I saw what he did with my brothers. I see what he has done with them right here in New York City. So make sure you obey the law. Make sure you never commit a crime. Make sure you never deviate from the law. But any time one of them puts his hands on you, take him off the planet. Take him off the planet.
Another great thing about it, no second guessing what he's thinking there, and that's wow. Anyways, let's move on, Peter, to the budget as promised. We're going to look at Barack Obama's budget, and we're going to look at it from a lens that the corporate media. I guarantee you, I did my media watching, and nowhere in the corporate media. Did you get this kind of analysis of the budget? You might have gotten on progressive media because there are progressive media out there, and God bless them. You know, the other folks who are doing great work, whether it's podcasts or independent media out there, college radio. Keep doing what you're doing if you're listening right now. Keep doing what you're doing because you inspire us, and if we can. Continue to play a role in getting this critical information out there, then so be it. So, Peter, you want to say something quick, and then we'll get up, we'll move on to the budget.
Yeah, just listening to that oration from Malcolm, you know, on the joke of the American so-called justice system. All we need to do is look at the so-called Supreme Court of the United States to see what a travesty that the so-called justice system is in this country. And, you know, we don't have time to talk about it now, but there are several definitive cases that I hope our listeners will take the time to familiarize themselves with if they're not already, just to underscore the joke that is the court system in the United States at the highest level. We don't have to go back very far to the Bush versus Gore decision, and then historically looking at Plessy versus Ferguson, and then looking at how the Supreme Court handled the 14th Amendment cases. I mean, in the 20 years following the passage of the 14th Amendment, virtually all of the cases were used for the benefit of corporations, when we know that amendment was passed specifically for the benefit of ex-slaves. Yet the Supreme Court used it as a tool to put forward the interests of capitalism. And then finally, the Dred Scott case. I just reread the opinion by the Supreme Court Judge Taney at the
Justice
time.
Taney.
And
yeah.
Taney, right. So, you know, I just want to commend that to our listeners. If you haven't read the Dred Scott decision, the opinion by Judge Taney, please look it up. Do, you know, get online, go to the library, find that judgment and read it, and that will underscore what the justice system in the United States is all about. If you're familiar with anything from that judgment, it's the piece about the black man has no rights which white men need to respect, and that's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of that judgment. So look that up. And then you see why Malcolm was able to speak with such indignation about the joke of the justice system in the United States. So look it up, Dred Scott decision. Do the research yourself and understand where Malcolm's coming from. All right, thanks, Solomon. Let's move on to talk about the budget.
Yeah, let's move on to the budget. But yeah, right on with your critical analysis and tying that in with the Dred Scott decision and that piece of crap, maybe he'd be roasted in hell, Judge Taney. But let's look at the budget. First, I don't know where to start. We can start on a couple of the obvious things first and foremost. We look at the, for instance, the Department of Defense, and we're going to compare and contrast. You know, Peter and I are going to compare and contrast this budget. Where we see an increase of $22 billion above the last fiscal year's appropriation or, you know, budget, you know, just basic. This is just, and folks, remember, this is just a basic budget because we know that each year, like the last couple of years, the U.S. has spent over $1 trillion. But wars, you know, as we know, are appropriated by Congress. You know, the funding for wars are appropriated by Congress. And we know, you know, that much of the nuclear installments and that kind of maintenance is tucked away into the Department of Energy and those type of things. So, but you know, looking at, and this is all available at Whitehouse.gov. But you're looking at the military, Peter, $553 billion for the base budget, which is an increase of $22 billion above the 2010 appropriation. And this is amazing because, you know, we know that this is an economy that is very, very much based around the military. It's the military industrial complex. So even when you had that other evil devil, Dwight D. Eisenhower, you know, see, Peter and I, I'm not going to dress up people, you know, just because Dwight Eisenhower said that he forewarned about a military industrial complex doesn't mean that we're going to dress them up like some other folks, you know, and not mention, you know, the evil scourges that they were. So just, I don't care if you say something that's like, you know, I guess quasi-progressive now, saying, oh, a president's warning about the military-industrial complex, you know, so you can be, you know, somebody on, you know, on Democracy Now! And talk about that. But I think that if you don't mention in the same vein, what these individuals did and the lives that these individuals took. You're not doing your job, because this is saying Dwight D. Eisenhower that gave the orders to assassinate the great, one of my other heroes, Patrice Lumumba. He gave the orders to assassinate him, to eliminate him. General Eisenhower, you know, he was a military man himself. But, you know, so this economy is very much based around this military industrial complex and the military intelligence complex, and, you know, all the contractors that go with it, that they get these no-bid contracts for billions of dollars, literally. But Peter, in contrast, why don't you jump in, Peter? When you contrast, you know, the defense spending, you know, that we just, you know, just spoke on, just gave a couple big numbers, and you contrast that with what's being spent this year on education, $77 billion on education, and we know that there's 14,000 different school districts within the United States of America, over 14,000 different school districts. So that's not even schools. That's just 14,000 school districts, and $77 billion goes to K through 12 education. And at the same time, we see the Pell Grant programs are being reduced. I mean, as if the $5,000 or $6,000 or $7,000 before was enough to send a kid to the average state school, it wasn't. So it damn sure well is not going to be enough. Now that it's being reduced, I mean, it shows, Peter, the stark contrast in the priorities of this government, and, you know, they continue to reap what they sow. You know, looking at the U.S., you know, ranked 26th, 27th when it comes to mathematics, sciences, and things of that nature. But beyond that, we see those who are the poorest and the most economically disadvantaged in this country. Those that come from those communities, where, you know, the vast majority of people in those communities are not property owners in terms of land or houses, they get the worst school systems, because property taxes, you know, play a major role in terms of, and that's very sick, Peter. If that doesn't epitomize like a capitalist nation that just, you know, we're going to reward the kids whose families, are opulent and own homes, but those were, you know, where there's, we know that there's parents working two and three jobs and are living in tenements or apartments. We're gonna punitively, you know, punish them by underfunding and under resourcing their school systems. But just look at that comparison, Peter. And, you know, and this whole race to the top. And Peter, one last thing is, folks, you know, looking at this whole race to the top crap. You know, first it was No Child Left Behind with George Bush, and then Barack Obama and Arne Duncan with this race to the top. They're literally holding, with this race to the top, how sick it is. They're holding a pouch of money above these schools and saying, all right, whichever schools perform the best, you're the ones that are going to get the pouches. You're going to get the money doled out to you. And so it's a sick competition, Peter. It's a sick competition. So if a school does not perform as good as the next, they don't get any of the purse money, the extra purse money, the extra paltry purse money that's being held over their heads. It is as pathologically sick as one can imagine. And folks, if you're listening right now, it is sick. We are not going to water stuff down. It is sick. It is disgusting. It is sick. Peter, your thoughts?
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely spot on in saying that it's pathological. You know, and I have some additional language, not different language, because you're right. It is pathological. But the way I look at it, it's violence. All right. It's economic violence. I mean, the federal and state budgets being proposed amount to organized economic violence on the people of the United States. Within the federal budget is a massive military outlay for the continued physical violence. You know, the wars and occupations around the world on the peoples of other countries. And then, you know, given these grim realities, only the willfully ignorant, which is delusional, right, can deny the disastrous nature of capitalism. You know, and what sectors benefit from this? You know, obviously the schools are losing out, like you mentioned. School children are losing out, like you mentioned. The people who are hurting the most are being punished the most. But who benefits? Like you said, the military industrial complex is benefiting. There's actually increases for the military and security complex. And also federal prisons got an increase. I mean, that is economic violence being perpetrated on people. And let's not forget the context in which these massive cuts are coming. We're talking about in the aftermath of what? Multi-trillion dollar bailouts, right, of Wall Street in 2007 and 2008, and then the ongoing wars on the Iraqi people and on the Afghan people. Those are draining multiples of trillions of dollars from the federal treasury. All right, taxpayer dollars were literally given away to corporations who squandered their money, who were fiscally irresponsible, basically casino capitalism, where the rich were getting richer and the poor were getting fucked, and federal tax dollars to the tunes of trillions were simply handed over to them, and then the wars on the Iraqi people and the Afghan people, and the military bases around the globe, and all the other overseas misadventures of the military complex. Now that's the background for these massive cuts, and then Solomon, and then the mouthpieces for capitalism, the politicians, have the audacity to get in front of the camera and to stand in front of reporters and say things like, quote, Medicare and Medicaid are huge problems. All right, that's what he said. He said Medicare and Medicaid are huge problems. Well, hello. Did we just have to bail out Medicaid and Medicare to the tune of trillions of dollars? I don't think so. And then he has the audacity to say the economy is growing again and people are more hopeful. Excuse me? You know, has he looked around the country lately? Does he know what's going on in Wisconsin? Does he know what's going on in California? Does he know what's going on in Arizona? Does he know anything that's going on? Yes, he does, Solomon. He's not a stupid man, but he's a mouthpiece for the apparatus. And so the narrative has to be put out there. The lie has to be put out there, and it has to be repeated over and over and over again. So you have the mouthpieces for the apparatus, that is the politicians, stand up and straight-facedly lie and repeat the narrative over and over and over again. It's the social problems, the social programs that are a problem. He said that. That's a quote. Medicare and Medicaid are huge problems. Wait a minute. He didn't say anything about the wars. He didn't say anything about the bailout of Wall Street other than the economy is growing again. No, the economy is not growing again. That's another thing. All right, we need to understand this. Whenever we hear one of the politicians, the mouthpieces for Wall Street, say things like the economy is growing, what they mean is corporate profits are growing. All right, there has been a fundamental a tectonic change in the economy of the United States over the past 20 or 30 years or so. Starting with Reagan, it was accelerated during the Clinton years, and then it just went off the charts over the last 10 or 12 years, is the financialization, all right, the financialization of capitalism in this country. In other words, it's all about finance. It's the casino capitalism where, you know, we don't have to produce anything anymore. We don't have to produce refrigerators and telephones and automobiles and you know, tangible products. You know, all those productive engines have been shipped overseas, and you know, and that's another conversation. Yet and still, corporations are sitting on mountains of cash. You know, their profits are growing, and they were able to have this, you know, this casino capitalism over the last several years because of all these deregulation policies and so forth, because of the financialization of the economy. We need to understand that, so they can say. They can say that the economy is growing, and there's a nugget of truth in that, that the banksters and the fat cats are getting richer, and yet and still working Americans are getting poorer and are not going back to work. As a matter of fact, right in the budget itself, the Obama administration anticipates basically the perpetuation of permanent unemployment at a high level. The American workers will remain on the unemployment rolls for much of Obama's four-year term in office. And it's funny too. They abbreviate fiscal year with FY, right? Well, it's not. It can be interpreted as, you know, fiscal year 2011, or also fuck you 2011, right? Because that's basically what the federal government is saying to the American people. But the budget assumes that unemployment rates this year will average around 10%. And are going to stay around 10% through the first term of Obama's administration. And we know that those numbers are ridiculously low. We know that those are just false numbers. You know, that the real unemployment rates are much, much higher, particularly for people of color, particularly for African Americans and Latinos. Those numbers are sometimes two, three, and four times as high.
Right.
So they anticipate permanent unemployment, permanent high unemployment, as a permanent feature of the future of the economy, and yet and still, the financial institutions, you know, finance, insurance, and real estate continue to grow. Now, if you stop for a minute and do the math and figure that out, you can see how the American people are getting screwed. And when you just look at the nuts and bolts of the budget, like you mentioned. Schools are getting slashed. Social services are getting slashed. You know, we see the attack on unions. What's happening in Wisconsin is kind of a snapshot of what's happening to working people. And yet and still, the war machine continues to grow, and the mass incarceration machine continues to grow. Like you said, the priorities of this government, Solomon, you said it. The priorities of this government were laid bare in this budget proposal. Not only the priorities of this government, but the priorities of this fraud who's sitting in the Oval Office right now posing as some kind of proponent of change, you know, and, you know, all this hope and change that we can believe in, right? Well, you know, we know that he idolized Ronald Reagan, but this is ridiculous. You know, he's out Ronald Reaganing. Ronald Reagan, you know, with some of these, the course of his economic policy in this budget. It is absolutely scandalous, Alan. It is absolutely scandalous, and it is it's a disaster in the making. It's a disaster in the making.
Right. And one of the slick things that they try to do, Peter, is that, you know, they try to, even on the liberal media, I saw, I mean, and this shows, people, this is what you know, we're trying to provide you is just a vision outside, a peek, if you will, if not more. Actually, we're trying to shove your head through the window, outside of the matrix, so you can see what it looks like, you know, just to kind of compare and contrast what things look like when they're spoken about honestly, as in comparison to when you know, even looking at the liberal media. I mean, Peter, when the budget first came out, had, you know, turned to MSNBC to see what these clowns were talking about, see if, you know, so it was Rachel Maddow's show. She's painted as like this liberal. I mean, and as Malcolm said, we're going to play something a little bit in a few minutes, you know, that there's not much of a difference, you know, in terms of actual, you know, policy, you know, between, you know, white liberals and white conservatives. You know, we've just kind of allowed ourselves to be programmed into thinking that there's a difference. But, you know, so I turned to MSNBC, Peter, and I'm watching, you know, as Rachel Maddow, and then she's just beside herself. Like, she's just like kind of just picking on the Republicans and the conservatives and those at Fox News, and she's like, oh, look, you know, they're not going to talk about the fact, look, you know, this, they're only spending $10 billion. See how much money, more money that we're going to have when these wars end. You know, people that wanted to criticize Barack Obama for drawing down the end of the war in Iraq, and, you know, so she had this little graph up. And she showed how, like, the new budget, you know, is proposing that only $10 billion is going to be spent. $10 billion going to be spent on the war, or on in Iraq this year. You know, we know that there's still troops there. I don't care if they call them non-combatant troops or what. They're still troops, and they're carrying guns, and they're still fighting that has still been going on. So anyway, but that's beside the point, Peter. So what's funny is these, like, slick folks want to put this here, this is graph, to try to, like, fool the folks that is that's the only amount of money that's being spent on in Iraq. And yeah, certainly that's a far cry from what has been spent on Iraq in previous years since the illegal invasion and occupation in 2003 of Iraq. But Peter, nestled in other areas, what they don't mention, Peter, is the other billions of dollars that are still getting pumped into Iraq by way of going to into the coffers of military contractors, and also, you know, the money that's being spent on that $500+ million embassy that they have in Iraq now. You know, so these are things, and then there's people don't know there's a $600+ million embassy that's in Pakistan. So if you really think that these folks don't have some kind of invested interest in remaining there when they build a $500 million embassy that has a heliport and has all the trappings of just a small city, of course they plan on being there. But Peter, like, we didn't get this kind of critical analysis from Rachel Maddow or folks on MSNBC. They were defending the president and defending little areas of his budget, you know, and not even hitting him hard, Peter, on the fact that he's also his and his sick administration have also this new budget cuts the home heating program for the poor. The name eludes me. But the program that enables poor folks from poor communities to actually have some aid towards heating their homes. So that's been cut, Peter. That clearly is an area that needs to be cut. And Peter, when you take the cuts in the Pell grants and you take the cuts that come along with the home heating program. Peter, they are an infinitesimal blip on the screen in regard to the overall budget. Peter, they could have doubled, they could have tripled, they could have quadrupled what they spent on Pell grants and this home heating program for the poor. They could have quadrupled it, Peter, and it still would be very small. But instead of quadrupling it or even doubling it, they cut it back. So it's even smaller. It is in comparison to the overall context of the budget. It is minute. It is tiny, 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 tiny. But you don't hear this on the corporate media. They you know, even the corporate liberal media, they just sit there and they grovel over this guy and defend him. And it's not saying that you defend these right-wing Republican bastards either. No, of course not. They are what they are. But we need to expose these monsters in wolves' clothing, you know, that we see on MSNBC and CNN, and expose these bastards for who they are as well, so that people understand, you know, that the trickery and step around these pitfalls in terms of allowing themselves to accept these narratives that are fed to them by folks who don't have quite frankly, Peter, they don't have any kind of vested interest in any like radical quick change to alleviate I love the way you said it, the economic violence that is being imposed on poor working class people in this country, whether they may be black, white, Latino, and I just wish, you know, it's just too bad that many of those working class white folks are so entrenched in their own ignorance and racism to get, you know, the whole larger solidarity picture. But, you know, some of them do get it, but many don't. Peter, this is what Malcolm had to say on white liberals, and then we'll go back to the budget on the other end.
White liberals who have posed as our friends, white liberals who have been eager to point out what the white man in the South has been doing to us, while they themselves here in the North are doing the same thing. They have been making a great fuss over the South, only to blind us to what is happening here in the North. And now that the eyes of America's 20 million blacks can easily see that this white fox here in the North is even more cruel and vicious than the white wolf in the South. The Southern wolves always let you know where you stand. But these Northern foxes pose as white liberals. They pose as your friend, pose as your benefactor, pose as your employer. They pose as your landlord. They pose as the neighborhood merchant. They pose as your lawyer trying to help you. They infiltrate all your organizations, and in this manner, by joining you, they strangle your militant efforts toward freedom, toward justice, and toward equality. They use integration for infiltration. Throughout America, here in the North as well as the South, masses of black people are demonstrating against the oppression and exploitation of the white man. Our people have lost all fear of the white man. They have ceased trying to waste their love on the white man. And they have ceased turning their nonviolent cheek to the violent white man. And because of this new, fearless, more militant attitude on the part of our people, we see the increase of violence and bloodshed between the white oppressor and the oppressed, between the white exploiter and the exploited, between the white slave master and his 20 million ex-slaves. And where will all of this end?
So, Peter, yeah, I'll let you go. You know, I'm
I love the way Malcolm phrases that when he talks about the foxes in the North as opposed to the wolves in the South. You know, I mean. And let's look at that. Let's look what Malcolm is speaking from. You know, he's speaking from the 1960s, and primarily the civil rights movement. There was a distinct line, obviously, between the Jim Crow South and the non-Jim Crow North. And so it was a very distinct difference, you know, between the wolves in the South, you know, with their Jim Crow and their, you know, their segregation now and segregation forever governors and their Bull Connors and so forth, you know, and the more subtle racism in the North, you know, and although the appearance of that has changed with time and with some of the civil rights achievements, the appearance of it has changed, Solomon. But the bottom line is the same. You're right. You know, the white liberalism, like Malcolm said, poses as friends of progress. But yet and still, I don't remember who used this language first, but particularly with reference to the Democratic Party, which has been, you know, the bastion of white liberalism. You know, the Democratic Party is the graveyard of progressive movements. And we've seen that over the last, you know, 10 or 12 years, how, you know, these liberal organizations, you know, try to champion the, at least in the rhetoric, at least in external appearance, they try to champion the ideals of the poor and the oppressed, and they take them on, and then nothing happens. You know, they politicize them. They play games with them, you know, and they engage in what, you know, Malcolm called, you know, trichnology, you know, and he uses the term foxes very purposefully, you know, the way they're sly and they're slick about defanging, you know, any kind of progressive progress, you know, toward liberation. And, you know, and some of the things that we can look at in terms of how one of the things that white liberals did, you know, coming out of the 1960s was how the movement towards black capitalism, you know, it was a lot of corporate entities got together with the federal government, particularly with the Nixon administration. You know, there were some big business CEOs and presidents of business got together with the Nixon administration and said, hey, you know what? let's try to pull some of the unrest of Black America underneath, you know, the umbrella of capitalism, you know. And that was a definitive example of white liberalism taking the teeth out of a real movement, you know. I mean you had Malcolm, you had Martin planning on poor people's campaigns that we're gonna bring millions of people to D.C. to shut down the government, and you know, Malcolm is developing the Afro American organization, and you know, to go, you know, neighborhood by neighborhood and block by block to organize, you know, that's the real work. And then, you know, the liberals come along and they say, no, you know, join us, you know, come on over to our side. And it turns out to be tricknology, to use Malcolmism again, you know. And so we need to recognize that. And you know, one of the things that Malcolm said in the earlier clip, you know, that I hope our listeners picked up on, he said, "I don't call myself a Democrat." You know, obviously he wasn't a Republican, and you and I have made that clear on the show before, because most people think that, you know, there's this ideology of dualism in Americanism, you know, that it's either one or the other. You know, that's why the color line is so instructive about racism, you know, because it breaks things down in terms of, you know, it's black or white issues, and that's a philosophical thing with Americanism. But I won't go down that road any further. But people either assume that you're either Republican or Democrat. And so people, you know, think, well, we must have voted for Obama because we obviously didn't vote for a Republican. Well, no, we didn't.
Uh-huh.
You know, and, you know, Malcolm's making that point also. He's, you know, I'm not a Democrat. I don't side with the white liberal organizations, you know, these so-called liberal organizations, the so-called liberal movements. No, there's got to be an alternative. And those were the things that Malcolm was moving towards at the end of his life. And that's why he had to be taken out. That's why he was so dangerous, because of, you know, the organization that he was planning, you know, the secular organization that he was planning, that he had founded, and that's when he became dangerous, when he was going to politicize in a very structural way. And that's another thing about Malcolm, is that he had a structural critique, and he was able to identify these structural obscenities. All right. That, you know, that the white liberalism refuses to identify, and again, Christianity, you know, white Christianity is in bed with white liberalism politically, and so they basically speak the same language, just in a different dialect. And Malcolm is able to critique and deconstruct both of those, and so he's saying I'm not part of that, and he's able to make those structural critiques and identify those things. You know, and we see that with the media now. We see the liberal media, you know, and the press conference. You know, I read some of the transcripts from the press conference when Obama put his budget out there. You know, and nobody suggested that maybe we should cut the military. They should cut the military spending. You know, nobody brought that up. Nobody mentioned this enormous military budget elephant sitting in the middle of the room. And, you know, that the United States already spends more than all the other nations on the planet, you know, and they continue to swallow the language that, you know, the real drivers of long-term debt are things like Social Security and Medicare. So that's where liberalism takes us. You know, it takes us down a dead-end road. And so, you know, again, underscoring the need for alternatives separate and distinct from the capitalist political system.
Right. And you know, and looking at that same capitalist political system, you know, you'll have people, you know, cheering and jeering for different aspects of the budget, overlooking things that quite frankly, you know, should not go overlooked. But you know, why would the mainstream media pay attention to the prison industrial complex and how the impact of spending, you know, last year they spent $6.185 billion on the federal prison system. That's just the federal prison system. And this year, you know, it's $6.791 billion on the federal prison system. So it's going up, and we see, And so even looking within that, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, wow, you know what I'm saying? Like, oh, wow, the, that's a lot, and they've gone up. But that's just half of the tale, because we know that like when you look at even Tennessee, most of their prisons now within the state of Tennessee are completely privatized. They're completely
right.
privatized. Like federal prisons now are, you know what I'm saying, are so much privatized. So, you know, you're just looking at money that's being spent by the federal government, but the federal government, you know, being, you know, the fascist government is, you know, being in cahoots, you know, with the corporate sector, you know, we see that they've created an agency and space for corporations to move in, Peter, to move into to this realm of building prisons. And
exactly.
Now they've just, you know, and they've just, you know, shipped their stock, their cattle, as they look at them, you know, these young men and women who are, and old men and old women who are incarcerated, and just, you know, ship them off like the cattle to the CCAs, the Correction Corporations of America, and the GEO Group, formerly known as Wackenhut. And we see that, you know, Corrections Corporation of America now is also big. They're the largest builder of detention centers for undocumented immigrants. You know, so they're you know, where we have like whole families that immigrant families that are being held in these detention centers. They're prisons in these, but
yeah.
They call them detention centers. They call them something other than that. But they're being held there. You know, these Latino men and women, and even folks from other countries, but primarily Latinos are being held in these detention centers for just, you know, for who knows how long, you know, weeks, months, you know, over a year, you know, just for just an unspecified time. And, you know, and I'm talking about kids, 12-year-olds, 7-year-olds, 6-year-old boys and girls in there with their families behind these detention. The better term, these internment camps. They're basically internment camps. And fully funded and supported by the federal government to these private, you know, these private corporations, you know, the Corrections Corporation of America. They're on the stock market. I mean, folks, if you haven't thought that it was sick before, I just want you to think. Just step outside of your comfort zone, and you know. No matter how big a patriot you are, I mean, if you're really a true patriot, then you should be disgusted anytime you hear of the inhumane things that this country does in your name. That's what makes you a real patriot. The other folks that masquerade around and support, you know, the inhumane things that are done in their name through the U.S. government, then you know they're not patriots. They're vile demons, you know. But if you think just for a second, that what kind of sick, twisted person or individual or government would actually make way for a prison system to be placed on the stock market in Wall Street? That means their shares go up. The more when the incarceration rates nationwide or within a certain district go up, when they go up, that means that the stocks are going to be triggered enough. If crime rates go down, Peter, if crime rates start to go down on the downswing, and quite frankly, folks, for the last 10 plus years, violent crime rates have actually gone down, but at the same time, you know, the funding of more cops and more prisons has gone up, and that's also on whitehouse.gov, those, you know, where you can see, you know, the hiring of more police officers and so forth. Then you'll have some idiots that will say, well, the crime rate's going down because we've hired more cops and more police officers, and that's why the crime rate goes down. No, actually, there's no empirical data to slightly suggest that that's the case. None whatsoever. No data whatsoever to suggest that stupid argument. But that is the pathological society, folks, Peter, that we live in. It's a country, and when I went to Norway this past 2010, and I was doing a talk out there on the prison industrial complex, and I mentioned that. It was wild, Peter. I told you this off air, but it was crazy. I mean, people were beside themselves. They were just looking bewildered. And when it came to the talkback session, that was one of the things that they just couldn't even come to grips with. That they're like the U.S. government, they privatized the prison system. It's on the stock market. That's in the stock market, because the prisons there in Norway are based off of reform and rehabilitation. Peter, they could not even understand that. They couldn't understand. They understood all the other stuff about the military. It's all fucked up and this, that, and the other. But it was beyond them. They just said that's inhumane. That's crazy, because you can't necessarily even say that you're in the business of rehabilitation or helping individuals when things are placed in the stock market. It's clear. It's a clear conflict of interest, and it's clear that resources are going to be placed into incarcerating individuals, because that's going to feed into that nefarious private sector that the U.S. government is so beholden to. Barack Obama and even Bush before him has been so beholden to, you know, looking at the bailouts and all this stuff. And Peter, one other thing, Peter, and folks, you know, it's J.P. Morgan. It's J.P. Morgan are the ones that are in charge of producing and doling out the food stamp cards, because then, you know, right. Now though that they're plastic, they are the ones that create those. So basically, these same, you know, MFers that are largely part of the reason why we're in this national and also global recession and depression in certain areas. These folks that got that large bailout money, and they're profiting at the tune. For instance, in the state of Indiana, J.P. Morgan, they profit each month about $186,000 from every time, you know, the amount of cards that they're making, the plastic cards that they're making. This is being paid by your tax dollars through the U.S. government. So they're basically, it behooves them to have folks impoverished, folks on WIC, folks on food stamps. It behooves them. They're banking, Peter, they're banking on poverty.
Yes,
on poverty.
Right. Yeah, that demonstrates that we reveal those things, and it demonstrates, it lays bare, it makes plain the predatory nature of capitalism. Capitalism is predatory by nature. I mean, you know, we see that going back to slavery. I mean, slavery was. I mean, if nothing else is predatory, slavery certainly was, right? We can all agree on that. I mean, it literally chewed up, ate up people's lives, you know, to the tune of tens of millions of Africans imported here to be slaves. And although slavery per se is no longer in operation, the system that used slavery and operated slavery and depended on slavery was never abolished, and I'm talking about capitalism. So it just needed to change or metamorphose, or kind of like a chameleon changing its colors, or shape-shifting a little bit. And so we see these different manifestations of the same system. Okay, there was slavery, and then there was sharecropping, and then there was the Industrial Revolution and all these other, you know, these evolutions in capitalism. And like I mentioned earlier, you know, we need to take note of the latest evolution, you know, the financialization, and like you're pointing out, you know, the privatization of these industries that literally benefit and profit off of human misery. So, you know, if nothing else, we need to wake up and understand the predatory nature of capitalism. And I think we have a call, so maybe we can take a minute and take a call, Solomon.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, we have a caller. I'm a pass this caller through quick. Can you make your question or comment quick, because we still have a lot of information we got to cover?
Hello?
Caller, you're on the line? Yes.
Hello?
Yes,
can
hello.
You
you're on the air. You're
yeah,
on live.
Good
yes, you are.
Good evening, Brother Solomon. How are you?
How are you doing?
This is Sister Asantewaa. How are you? Happy New Year.
Oh, good. How are you doing?
I'm learning the technology here with your show. I'm learning the technology, so I do apologize. I want to thank you for your guest and your program, because today is the anniversary of the murder of Malcolm X. But if I can say real quickly, I think it's interesting, you know, unlike the Malcolm X movie, September 17th, 1964, Malcolm X was in Egypt, and he had an article in the Egyptian Gazette called Zionist Logic, which was like an introductory for those of us in the United States about Zionism and how it really works. And at the time that Malcolm was in Egypt, he was there at the invitation of Nasser. He had been there for about 4 or 5 months. So looking at what's going on in Egypt now and some other things regarding Palestine, I think your conversation is very timely, and I hope we continue to watch what happens in Egypt and how the U.S. will try to manipulate that situation and see how a lot of things that Malcolm X taught us back in the day is still true even today. So thank you all very much.
Thank you. No, thank you. That's really on point. I didn't even think about that, but it's so important that you brought that up. It's so, so very important. And I really appreciate you hearing that, and also, more importantly, hearing your voice.
Thank you.
So thank you. Yeah, that sister is right on point, and she's long. And I know her. It's been a while since I've heard her voice, but she's been a long-time activist in D.C., and really appreciate the work that she's done. And that's a great, great comment that she brought up. Right on, spot on comment. Especially given the context that we're in, you know, this revolutionary period that we see in the Maghreb, in northern Africa, in Egypt and Tunisia, and now we see Libya going through the same thing, and very bloody right now as well. So, but looking at that context, Peter, when we kind of look at just this past week, which is something that the corporate media also didn't talk about, and I'm glad she called in, because it's triggered my thinking in terms of looking at the international scope of things. Peter, last week it came out that in Pakistan, the North Waziristan part of Pakistan, U.S. and NATO forces killed 61 folks. And so there's some kind of debate around how many of those folks were civilians. And so the numbers that U.S. and NATO forces are saying, there were 31 members of the Taliban that were destroyed. Even if that's the case, that means that the rest of them, which the Pakistani government and Human Rights Watch put out, that the large portion of them were women and completely children. And no talk about that, Peter, but these drones and these airstrikes, and I mean, because they weren't, and these primarily were airstrikes that were conducted. These airstrikes, these just indiscriminate airstrikes, you know, all in the name, and they basically eschew it and say, oh, well, it's collateral damage. It's collateral damage, you know, if they even say that at all. Is done in the name of what? And this new report that was put out by Wayne Madsen, if you guys go to Wayne Madsen report, this is something that he just put out, saying extensive research that he has unearthed that is unveiling that the CIA has been in Pakistan, has been doing these false terrorist attacks where they've actually been the ones who have been detonating some IEDs to justify an intensification of the war in Pakistan, and to justify saying, oh, all right, you know, well, our intelligence is right. There, we've got so many Al-Qaeda cells in Pakistan, so. This is to justify that we need to go in there, and this is so funny. I mean, because you know Raymond Davis is this American who is being held. He shot and murdered two Pakistanis who he said they were trying to rob him. But the guy was he was carrying two or three cell phones, Peter. He had, you know, a couple passports. He had all this kind of like whatever. And you know, first says that he was a contractor out there. And, you know, and he's also former Special Forces, but firstly, you know, contractor out there. The U.S. is now saying that he has diplomatic immunity. So Obama and even John Kerry was out there last week to try to lobby to get them to release him. But the Pakistani people are no fools. They're protesting loud and clear, and they want this guy to see justice. But he just – and then another U.S. official came through and ran over and killed, murdered – another Pakistani, this guy was trying to aid, you know, Raymond Davis. So this other American came and just completely ran over this guy. So that's three Pakistanis that are dead, surrounded by these events. And so it's just interesting and just to see the like what you know President Obama has, and I hate calling him president, but President Obama has said he's totally in support of Raymond Davis receiving diplomatic immunity. But what's funny, Peter, is when you look at the Afghani woman who just got it was close to a life sentence. She got something like 70 or 80 years, and she's the one who pulled out a gun and. She didn't even kill anybody, but she was, you know, defending herself. She was held in custody by U.S. forces. I forget her name. It'll come to me. But, you know, she was given something like 70, 80 years. And then, you know, we've seen other folks who have been caught on the battlefield, you know, fighting U.S. forces or were put into Guantanamo Bay. And then I forget the other brother's name, but he was just sentenced to life in prison. So it's just kind of interesting that this would never happen on U.S. soil. If the roles were reversed, they would never allow, you know, so-and-so to be released. They would never allow him. They would want him to seek justice. If a Pakistani was in the U.S. He shot and killed, you know, two folks who he said were robbing him in New York City or Arizona or what have you. There's no way they would release him without having to stand trial, especially if the evidence pointed that it wasn't a robbery, that this was flat out murder. But yet there, you know, President Obama is not on the side of justice. He's clearly not on the side of justice. He's asking for diplomatic immunity to have this guy Raymond Davis released. There is no justice, Peter. There absolutely is no justice.
Well, yeah, you're right. And for a caller, you know, that's a great comment. Appreciate you calling in. And for you and other listeners who haven't heard our show on the Palestine Papers, I want to encourage you to go to the Your World News Archives and look up our show on the Palestine Papers, and we talk about Zionism in there. It's one of the pieces of the puzzle, you know. So it's part of this conversation as well. So I'm glad you brought that up and kind of expand our conversation tonight. And it's very timely. It's right on point in our tighter conversation on Malcolm because of Malcolm's what? His international perspective, particularly after his break with Nation of Islam and his internationalist perspective, you know, and that's the kind of perspective, you know, that all progressives need to have. And, you know, we need to look globally and understand what's going on a global stage, you know, and why so we can develop solidarity, you know, with working people around the globe because we have more in common. All right, we need to hear this. Everybody needs to hear this. Tell it to somebody, you know, tonight, tomorrow, that we all have more in common, you know, with the victims of these drone attacks and the military attacks in Iraq and Pakistan and Afghanistan. We have more in common with those Afghans and Pakistanis and so on and so forth, with the victims of American imperialism and global capitalism than we have in common with the elitists, the ruling class here in the United States that are perpetrating these acts through the use of the United States government and their physical violence of the U.S. military. You know, we need to understand that. And just to underscore the duplicity and the hypocrisy of the United States government on the global scale, this is Vice President Joe Biden, okay? This is Barack Obama's vice president, you know, the second in charge. He said this in July of 2009, that Israel has this sovereign right, okay, and it's a quote, has the sovereign right to attack Iran if it so chooses. And the United States could not do anything to hinder any such action because Washington, quote, cannot dictate to another sovereign nation what they can and cannot do, end quote. Okay? Obviously, he does not imply that Iran has the sovereign right to attack Israel, right? Or that you know, any other country could do that. So, I mean, just listen to that for a moment. You know, he's saying that Israel has the sovereign right to attack Iran if it so chooses, and the U.S. could do nothing about it. It's the business of the U.S. to dictate to other countries what they can and cannot do. And that's what we see happening in Pakistan, obviously. It seems to be the story is unfolding, that the CIA is actually an incendiary agent for the escalation of military activity in that country. You know, and it's nothing new. It's nothing new, is it, Solomon? And we've seen these false flag operations for over a century. And that, again, exposes, and I'll say it again, the predatory nature of capitalism. We need to understand that. And you know what is so hypocritical is that during the so-called Cold War, you know, it was the flag-waving U.S. patriots that used to berate the Soviet Union and scare Americans and Westerners in general, you know, with the communist threat, because, you know, they said that communists wanted to take over the world. Well, wait a minute. Look at what the United States is doing now. Look what capitalism is doing now. You know, the United States has military bases in how many countries? You know, how many hundreds of military bases, and hundreds of millions of dollars going into these so-called embassies, you know, and pursuing markets to every corner of the globe and natural resources at gunpoint and all these things. And then tell me who it is that seeks to take over the world and dominate the globe. You know, so the hypocrisy and the lies are staggering, absolutely staggering, and especially when we start to put all these pieces together. And I wish we really had time to get into all these various pieces, you know, the pieces in that are Libya and Egypt and even Bahrain now and all these other places, from North Africa to the northern Midwest. Look what's happening in Wisconsin, and it's spilling into Ohio and into Kentucky, you know, and all kinds of things that have been going on in the United States that, you know, the liberal media somehow has chosen to you know, give scant coverage to. But we need to look at all these pieces together and have a global perspective and then develop some global solidarity. And that's where Malcolm was. That's where Malcolm was, and I'll say it again. That's why he was so dangerous that he had to be taken out. The United States government could not tolerate somebody with his perspective as well as, you know, the kind of charisma, you know, and leadership that Malcolm had. Same thing with Martin. Same thing with the Black Panther Party. The U.S. government had to take them out. They had to take them out, you know, to perpetuate the system, to perpetuate the apparatus, and to keep, you know, the people, to keep us, to keep we the people under their oppressive rule. So we need to understand that. I'm glad she brought up, you know, that piece that Malcolm wrote. You know, because it opens up a whole other chapter to our discussion, and we need to have that global perspective, Solomon.
And along the lines of the global perspective, and glad Asatwa, you know, alluded to this when she alluded to Zionism, and having this global perspective, folks. But if anyone out there, because if we want to really keep our eyes on the ball, you know, our eyes on the prize, if you will, when it comes to justice in that region of the world. We know that you know, Libya and Egypt and Tunisia are part of Africa. They're part of North Africa, Northern Africa. but that whole region there and then extending to, you know, what's now commonly referred to as the Middle East. When you look at what's now commonly referred to the Middle East, the most repressive and most oppressive and hardline government in that area is one of the U.S.'s number one allies. And I'm going to say the dirty little word that if you say it in the U.S., if you call them out in the U.S., you know, if you're the likes of Senator McKinney or Congressman Hilliard from Alabama, or looking at, you know, even the elder stateswoman in the White House coverage, you know, Helen, gosh, what's her last name? I keep forgetting her last name, but Helen Thomas, you know, you face the backlash of these, you know, regressive elements, these Zionist elements in the U.S. that will stop at nothing to continue to perpetrate and perpetuate just the just mass carnage and suffering that they're causing the Palestinians, whether they may be in Gaza Strip, whether they may be in West Bank, whether they may be in East Jerusalem, or even those Palestinians who are Israeli citizens. But yes, Israel is the most repressive and oppressive government in that region. In that region, if you look at what they're doing and what they have been doing to Palestinians dating back to 1947-48, and how it has intensified, the building of settlements is just one thing, but every week there are people that die unnecessarily because of what the government, you know what I'm saying, you know, and that the government, the Knesset, and you know what I'm saying, and it doesn't matter what party it is, whether it's the Likud party, you know, they pretty much are uniform across the board, or the vast majority of them endorse this. You know what I'm saying? You look at, you know, Avigdor Lieberman. That dude is a monster. You know,
right.
You know, and Benjamin Netanyahu, and you know, we can go on and, you know, on and on. But the government of Israel, you know what I'm saying, continues every week. You have children and women and men who die unnecessarily, whether they're not able to get the proper health care services for very treatable physical illnesses. So the obvious one is to point out the gunshots, you know, from the IDF soldiers and the firing of bullets and also rubber bullets and them piercing people's temples when they hit them and the knocking down of olive trees that have been alive for 50, 60, 70, 100 years. We can go on and on, but these people cannot even control their own water. I'm talking about people in Gaza Strip. They cannot even control their own water. They cannot even control their own electricity. Their electricity, again, maybe 6-7 hours of electricity a day, and it is being controlled by folks in Tel Aviv. I mean, this is real, folks. This is real. If you were incensed what was happening to, you know, our brothers and sisters in Azania, otherwise known as South Africa, during apartheid, if you were incensed by that, if you have any kind of consistent moral compass, you are incensed. You should be incensed. But what is going on, in Palestine? What is being done to those people? And here's the thing, to tie it back, Peter, into that whole budget, is that Obama approved the spending of the funding this upcoming fiscal year of $3.25 billion to Israel's military alone, to their military alone. They are the only country in that area that has fully fledged nuclear weapons. The only country that has nuclear weapons in that area.
They have a highly sophisticated military. They have a highly sophisticated intelligence apparatus known as Mossad that carries out, just like the CIA, that carries out extrajudicial assassinations, as we saw what they did this past year in Saudi Arabia. They do those all the time as well, all the time. I mean, there are Mossad agents roaming throughout the United States right now, spying on the U.S. and other cells that are antithetical to the state of Israel in terms of, you know, their human rights, their deplorable human rights record. But the U.S. government, and it breaks down to something like $82 million a day. That's $82 million a day that could be going to financing and building up these schools in governmentally neglected communities. That's $82 million a day that could be going towards community centers and programs for impoverished women that have been sexually abused, you know, protective services for them and recovery systems for women, you know what I'm saying, for single mothers who have been abused by their partners. I mean, these are all kinds of programs that $82 million a day could go towards. Where is our humanity that we continue to allow our own government to finance this repressive and oppressive regime in that region of the world? That is, I'm telling you, people, it is sickening. If you even come close to knowing what Palestinians are going through, what kind of hell they are going through, what kind of hell these children are going through, and how they're being robbed of a happy childhood because of this, and our tax dollars fund it. That brings things completely full circle, Peter Fowler.
It does. You know, you're exactly right. And you know, you look at these massive amounts of money. And this comparison, let's do the comparison thing again. We look at what's going on in the state of Wisconsin, you know, and this fabricated budget crisis that the governor has cooked up. And by the way, the governor of Wisconsin is a puppet of the Koch brothers. The Koch brothers funded Governor Walker's campaign. I'm sorry, Governor Scott. Scott Walker, they funded his campaign with just a flood of cash, and so, you know, we can point to that governorship as a clear case of corporate ownership of political office, and the governor of Wisconsin clearly doing the bidding of corporate America, and, you know, cooking up this budget crisis as a way of hacking. Working people's rights to unionize and collective bargaining and so on and so forth. And the point of that is, you know, that 2 days' worth, basically, Solomon, if you broke down that $3.25 billion that's appropriated to Israel's military, just 2 days' worth of that, they were to take 2 days' worth of that, just funded for 2 days less per year, and give that money to the state of Wisconsin, that would more than fill the budget deficit that the governor has fabricated and says he needs to attack workers' rights for. Just take 2 days worth of that. So take a couple more days and give it to Ohio, and a couple more days and give it to Maryland, a couple more days and give it to Arizona. Because in Arizona, let me tell you what's going on out here with Medicaid out here. Arizona's health care plan, which I was actually denied. I was denied benefits to the Axis plan out here, and the governor wants to scrap an additional 250,000 recipients of the federal health insurance plan in the state of Arizona, and there's even more reactionary elements in the Arizona legislature that want to scrap Axis entirely. And why? Because of these so-called budget crises that they just cook up because of the cuts in, you know, money that's coming from the federal government, and that is going directly to Israel is going directly into the military-industrial complex to perpetrate these wars all over the place in Mesopotamia and so forth, and continue to occupy Haiti, and continue this ridiculous, fraudulent so-called war on drugs in Colombia and in Mexico. And so when we tie those pieces together and we connect those dots, we can really see, like you said earlier, the priorities of this government. The priorities of this government are clearly to address the interests of American capital. So the American government is doing the bidding, and you know, I mean, it's getting more and more clear every day for those of us who choose to open our eyes and look at it, for those of us who choose to not be willfully ignorant, for those of us who choose to not be deluded and to not be brainwashed by the narrative, okay, the story that gets made up about, you know, America is the land of the free and the home of the brave and, you know, life, liberty, and all that crap, you know. But let's look at the facts. Let's look at what's really going on, all right? Show me the money, right? Show me the money. Where is the money going? It's going into prisons. It's going into wars. It's going into military aid to oppressive regimes like the state of Israel. And the state of Israel is a monster of a nation. And you know, and obviously it's supported entirely by the United States. Now tell me, how could a tiny little country like Israel, that's only been in existence since 1947, have a fully stocked nuclear arsenal that is capable of obliterating any nation even close to it, only with the help of the United States? You know, so it's clearly a political maneuvering, and the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan and now incursions into Pakistan, they're only an extension of that same type of priority by the United States government, doing the bidding again of American capital. All right, so it goes back to that capitalist system. We need to understand that, and we need to understand that with the budget, what's happening with the budget is a literal dismantling of civilized society. It's a literal dismantling of civilized society, and we're seeing it unravel, Solomon. We're seeing it unravel in places like Egypt, in places like Libya, in places like Bahrain and Tunisia. We're seeing it unravel, and we're seeing people get fed up and start to stand up and fight back against the apparatus. And you know, that whole revolution that's going on in Northern Africa, you know, that's a whole show in and of itself. But understand that what's happening in those places is directly connected to what's going on in Washington, D.C., and what's going on, you know, in Phoenix, Arizona, and in Columbus, Ohio, and in Madison, Wisconsin. You know, these are not disconnected, arbitrary events, all right? But these are all part of a global scheme, and we need to look at it that way, all right? We need to take Malcolm's lead, all right, and look at things internationally, you know. And if we were able to take our concerns to the United Nations the way that Malcolm had intended to, you know, maybe we could make some progress here. But you know, the reality of it is that Americanism is about death and about destruction, despite the narrative, okay? Despite all the picnics on the 4th of July and despite all the you know, the holiday hullabaloo on Christmas and Thanksgiving and these trappings of the narrative that keep people distracted, and, you know, and the Super Bowl and March Madness and all this crap that keep people entertained and distracted, you know, and uninformed, you know. And then we go back and we see what's happening in the public schools and the budget in public schools and the so-called race to the top, Solomon. And it's no wonder that the apparatus wants people to be stupid and uninformed and underfund public schools and not teach history and let the state of Texas literally rewrite history, you know, for the sake of white supremacy and for capitalist oligarchies. You know, it's no wonder that they want to keep people stupid. And so just the act of getting informed, just the act of informing yourself and opening your eyes and refusing to be deluded is an act of defiance and an act of rebellion, you know, and every one of us is capable of doing those things. And that's right. The first step in taking a step towards global solidarity. That's what we need to do. That's where we need to start, right here at home.
Exactly. It starts right here, and the pressure
I mean, why not? You know, why not people go out there and practice some civil disobedience? I mean, imagine if we, you know, this can continue to build momentum, and what we see in places like Wisconsin, you know, just, you know, in a positive way, metastasize throughout this cancerous fabric of American society, and you know, and break it down so they can be built, rebuilt, and regrown into something more humane, you know, that can impact people across the board, you know, regardless of background or whatever their background is, you know, can provide them, you know, affordable housing, a livable wage, you know, and universal health care. I mean, in a society that is devoid of abusive, power hungry, you know, cops that brutalize the poorest and the blackest and the brownest among all of us. You know, what is society? You know, you have to visualize it. You have to be a visionary like King and the great Malcolm X were. You have to be a visionary to see that society being birthed, because if you can't visualize it, then it makes it so much more difficult for it to really come to fruition. So I'm going to give the last word to Malcolm, and you know, on behalf of Peter Fowler, I want to thank everyone who's listening, and thank you so much, Asadawa, for calling in, and you know, and we're going to be having another show probably on Thursday surrounding education. I think we're going to have Danny Weil on. So if you're listening, just sign up for the alerts, and every time that we have a new show, you'll get alerted that there's a new show. And please send a link along to your friends and comrades. You know, send along. You know, we spend a lot of time sending these, you know, chain emails and jokes around. You know, send the link around. You know, have your folks listen in, because this is, we don't get paid for this. This is, you know, our duty, you know, as concerned, you know, citizens to give back, you know, by any means necessary. And so here's Malcolm X, and I'm going to let him have the last word, because it's so fitting, and may his words and work continue to live on in all of us.
So, brothers and sisters, if you're a present demand today here in America for more of the white man's jobs, which are already scarce, can lead to nothing but violence and bloodshed. It may even lead to a race war, a bloody race war. And it is the government itself that is now pressing the people of this country into a racial bloodbath. Government policy is doing nothing but instigating the two races toward nothing but a clash, a racial bloodbath. But what white people in this country should be made to understand, this is a new day. And our people, this generation, is a new people. That old Uncle Tom type Negro is dead. He's gone. Tom is gone. Our people have no more fear of anyone. They have no more fear of anything. We're not afraid to go to jail. We're not afraid to give our very life itself. And what's most important, we're not afraid to take the life of those who try and take our life. Did you hear what I said? This is the basic difference between this generation and former generations. We'll give our life just like that. But not only will we give it, we'll take the life of the one who's trying to take our life. We believe in a fair exchange. We believe in an eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth, and a head for a head, and a life for a life. That's justice. There's nothing wrong with that. An eye for an eye, and tooth for a tooth, and an arm for an arm, and a head for a head, and a life for a life. When you have that kind of philosophy, no one will put his hands on you. You walk around here cheek turning and enemy loving while you have knots on your body from the top of your head to the sole of your feet. If the white man doesn't turn his other cheek, you don't need to turn your other cheek. If the white man doesn't learn to love his enemy, you don't need to love your enemy. If the white man doesn't give up his life easily, you don't need to give up your life easily. If it's hard to take his life, it should be hard for him to take your life. That's justice. Why, his Bible even says, he who kills with the sword will be killed by the sword. That's what his Bible says in the 13th chapter of Revelation in his Bible. He who leaves into captivity will go into captivity. That's justice. How you gonna make a man a slave and think you're too good to be made a slave? Why, if the Bible is right, then the white man has to go into slavery. If the Bible is right, then the white man has to be lynched. If the Bible is right, the white man has to be made to suffer the same things that our people have suffered. It's justice. And if this is the price of freedom, we won't hesitate to pay that price.